my talk is called Building and Nurturing a Citizen Science Network with Fishermen and Fishing Communities Post-DWH Oil Disaster. And pictured there is our friend Wilma Subra, who was an essential part of our project. She's our community science consultant and did a lot of training, which we'll go into. And there are some people out on a boat taking shrimp samples from a shrimp catch. I have no relationship to disclose, except I am closely related to these communities now, but there's nothing financial about it. And this is the basic roadmap of what we're going to look at, overview the structure of the project, just so you know what we're talking about, the benefits to the communities and the project from directly getting fishermen involved in the sampling process, a survey of the environmental health literacy concepts, training protocols, techniques, and sustainability in the citizen science network we tried to put together, and the benefits to science enhancing the power of research expertise with local knowledge and local energy. This is a CBPR project. It was mandated when this RFA came out that the projects be community-based, and participatory research is where we took it because Dr. Kassan, that's her specialty within another core of our center. And that means that we're beginning research topic with a topic of importance to the community with the aim of combining knowledge and action. So the community helped in framing the reason for doing this, the goal, the aims and objectives, and a little bit of the scientific goal too. Although, you know, that of course has to be somewhat limited. This is the structure of the project, what we were doing. The coalition of community organizations were from Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas. The academic institutions were UTMB, University of Pennsylvania, Texas A&M, and LSU. And there are four parts of the project, and we're talking here about part four, community outreach, education, dissemination. These are the community and academic partners. I'm not going to read them all to you, but it's a wide range from Coden, Mobile Bay, Alabama, all the way over to Texas. These are some of the things that were designed into the project. The Fishing and Community Hub coordinators working together identified things that we can't identify. And these are the things that they really brought to the project. They helped us extend the scope of the research into a lot further into social determinants of health than we could do otherwise. They offer access to anecdotal evidence, daily anecdotal evidence about what's going on the water and in their communities. They help these networks carry breaking news. When this project began, the situation was pretty highly charged politically. There was a lot of hurt, anger, a lot of mistrust, distrust up and down the Gulf, and breaking news was happening all the time. This is not the case so much anymore. The community hubs and fishermen helped us clarify risk perception, which is all colored by that tumult and dynamic I was talking about. They provide reportage of the state of the ecosystem, and some of this was pretty nuanced. Our A&M collaborator came up with a list of questions that he asked me to ask the fishermen whenever we had fishermen's forum. This had to do with tarballs and sightings of this and that, types of deformities you might see in your catch. Is your catch, you know, proportionally smaller or larger than it had been? Are things moving around? They're not where they used to be, and your fishing ground is going to have to be changed, that kind of thing. And they help the community hub coordinators, these aren't necessarily fishermen, help convey the logistical risk and health promotion messages, but so do the fishermen on another level, another way. And the community hubs provide expertise in navigating this regional social dynamic that we truly don't understand. I mean, how could we? We didn't live there. And we don't fish for a living. We don't really, these communities were new to us and we were new to them. This is the design of the sampling part of the project, the marine life sampling. This is what I'm going to talk about. And we're looking at shrimp, white and brown, oyster, blue crab. These are the major commercial species. The fin fish are things people eat, you know, periodically when available. Flounder is a commercial species, but of all of the rest of them, I'm discounting snapper and grouper because they're much further out in the waters than we really went most of the time. The rest of this was subsistence fish, and especially speckled trout. People eat that constantly. It's easy to catch. So we're looking at them. We're looking for the presence and levels of pathogenic PAHs in seafood tissue, observation of those levels over time, with an idea of commenting on bioaccumulation or not. The idea of proportional exposure was how we put together the sampling matrix. You'll see a map later of that. And that just means some places got more oil than others, and we're really going to look at that closer. The state of Louisiana got the most oil. We did the most sampling there. We did less in Mississippi and about the same in Alabama. The community hubs helped to identify strategic sampling sites and alterations and patterns of species behavior numbers. And the protocols that we used with the fishermen were developed by Wilma, and they're based on an EPA reference here. This is guidance for doing these kinds of sampling projects. And we followed these protocols religiously because we wanted these samples to be scientifically credible. These are the hubs that we worked out of. Okay. We have a Mississippi Vietnamese American hub, a United Home and Nation hub, Alabama Fisheries Cooperative, and Louisiana Environmental Action Network, which helped us with fishermen that were all over the place, people that they were in contact with. And some of them were actually not necessarily fishermen, but were field biologists who went out and did this with us too, or for us, basically. Okay, the rationale for working with the fisherman-based field science network, it's consistent with the values of CBPR. This is going to help with trust and transparency. We really had to rebuild that because it did not exist. Institutions from elsewhere were not considered beneficent or helpful at that point. It allowed for geographical flexibility. We could respond agilely to capture field samples as things changed. They would tell us where to go. They also had the professional skill to get things, and they directly collaborated in the field with us. They had a respected position in the community. Fishermen in fishing communities are very well respected. And if they would say something about, you know, make a comment on somebody's credibility, that really meant a lot. So we're going to work with these guys. The fishermen were the obvious keystone in developing and enhancing regional environmental health literacy on the very basic neighborhood level. And they were a group with the strongest vested interest in assessing damage to the food web, so they really would do this work, because this is their livelihood, and they did not want to sell a bad product. And they were in a real bind, because they were afraid they were going to find something, but they wanted to know what was there. This is a map of the workflow between the hub coordinators, the science CODC, and the outreach and collaboration with the fishermen. Starting with the fisherman forum process, which recruited, basically taught the protocols. The fishermen went out and got the fish, brought them back, and the stuff was then analyzed using GCMS in our lab, and then we get back to the communities. This is a relationship of the fishermen's network, the hub coordinators, and university science, okay, in terms of an iterative multi-directional communication network. This is how we're communicating with one another. And they're at the top of the pyramid. They are the ears, eyes, and hands on site. This is the conceptual diagram of the types of skills we're trying to develop in terms of the citizen science network. The fisherman sampling network worked with protocols, chain of custody, PAH. What is a PAH, dose response. We didn't frame it like that exactly, you know, frequency, duration, all that. We talked about, you know, what you were exposed to, how long you were there, how old were you when it happened, you know, was kids being exposed, were people who were pregnant or nursing being exposed, because that's different. The food web concept, we talked about that, and of course, they were the connection with their consumers. And then the community hubs had a different set of things that they were working with, but also the previous group. So it kind of like a set of nesting boxes. And all the way up to the science team. And the last part of the science team's thing, cultural fluency and risk messaging and collaborative interpretation, these are very important factors that science had to learn from the community. So this was also an multi-directional situation. This was not easy either. I mean, we're working with bench science, clinical science, and communities that may or may not have much science background at all, and they had to learn to talk to one another. And it all began with the exposure and sampling workshops that happened in a variety of places you wouldn't believe, informal venues, I like to call them. Why it's so dark in this picture here is because it was taken at 4 o'clock in the morning, starting out on a shrimping expedition. Here is Wilma Subra. She's doing an orientation on the sampling protocols and the idea of dose response to these guys. Well, they're not all guys. Barbara Robbins here, she's a processor, not a shrimper, but she wanted to get involved in it too. She normally works on shore. And then over here, we see Wilma mentoring Barbara once again, showing her how to do the sample, make sure she keeps it clean, why you're wearing your gloves, how you use the foil, how many folds of foil you have to do, and how to do a label. And here she is at a fishing club. And these are guys who would go out and do fin fishing for fun. And they helped us with all the fin fish we brought in. This was a more difficult group to work with, just logistically, because they were harder to connect with after the training. And some of them didn't like to actually clean the fish. And that was part of the protocol. So sometimes the hub coordinator had to do that part. And here's the content of the Fisherman Science Network training. Orientation to the goals of GC Harms, what the PAH assessment was all about in food and humans. The basic science of what's a PAH, why are they concerned, what's the difference between pyrogenic and petrogenic, which is the big thing about our project. We're looking at petrogenic PAHs. They're building blocks, they're components of crude oil. They're not combustion products. Most PAH things you hear about are all about combustion products. If you look it up on the ATSPR tox facts, it'll be about pyrogenic PAHs. We're working with Petro, so we wanted them to know the difference. We talked about, like I said, dose responses and health links. And then we looked at methods, tools, and techniques in the field. And this was all the stuff they needed to use and how they needed to use it, including the field report, which is very important. It had the GPS location. It had all the physical descriptions of what the environment was like at the time. The depth of this, the water they were in, the temperature of the water they were in, a number of other things. And the chain of custody, without which the samples are meaningless, because then they're not scientifically credible without a chain of custody. And then we talked about the methods, tools, and techniques used in the lab in a very informal way. There was no test given at the end for any of this. But talked about bioassays, the blood work, talked about the GCMS and what it's used for and how. And, you know, honestly, if you talk about something in plain language, it can all be understood. And just stay away from the jargon. And then we talked about their responsibilities, which were very important. Purity of the samples, the chain of custody, the field report, information, storage, pickup, shipping. And we talked about stipends. And without stipends, I suppose this probably wouldn't have worked as well. But these guys are doing this for a living. It's interrupting their workflow, which is an important thing, because fishing is fast, and then it's nothing. It's you know, wait a long time, and then work really hard. And in the middle of the hard work, they have to stop and do this. So they got a very small stipend to do this. And we also helped pay, if we had to go out on a separate expedition, which was non-commercial, we paid for their fuel and the food and a deckhand, plus the captain. Now, we didn't do that very often because it's very expensive. And this is a connection with the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. They are a regional video hub for the project, and we're about to put another piece of video up on their website, but they're keeping track of it in that way, because everybody kind of said, well, nobody in these communities is going to be using the internet. Well, that's not true. Everybody's using it. They have kids, they're using it. And so this was important for them too. Now here's some of our tools, our sampling tools. Here's a guy with a, this is a single rig rear trawl hoist, and he's working the hoist, and this was our Mobile Bay sampler, and I just want to show you a little bit of what it looked like. Here's a crabber. These are really small boats, very low to the water, and they get buffeted around by the wave action. It's really amazing to go out on them, and this is very crazy work because you dump the crabs out and they run all over the place, and then you have to confine them. And here's an oyster sample being shucked and labeled, and that's what it looked like before it was shucked and labeled. And we should 20 to a sample. And here's our map. Now, this will be on the Louisiana Environmental Action website in an interactive format. This is not interactive with pop-up boxes that will have the location. Well, I'll go into that. We're going to get to that. But this is all of our samples, 208 discrete samples, many more organisms than that, however. And this is how it broke down in terms of the people that did the sampling, how many from each site we took. And notice that the shrimp sample could be anywhere from 20 to 75 per sample. Oyster samples are 20. Blue crab, 5 large and 7 medium. And these are the things we have to continue to do for care and maintenance of this network. And the next steps for our web prep and beyond, the project sample site map is going up. And I have another slide that goes into that in a little more detail. Our consumption guideline, which is now ready for prime time, although not fully cooked yet, because there's some bench science going on that has to be settled before we can truly say, black and white, this is your actual consumption guideline. But the communities need something as a rule of thumb while they're eating from the web the whole time we're doing this. And this is a long time coming. But it was difficult because the toxicology on petrogenic PAHs is an unsettled thing. It hasn't really been broached yet. And this is the major cutting edge thing about this project. We are also going to be doing community forums in the following communities, Montague, Los Isleños, Viras, Lafitte, Houma, Gulfport, Biloxi, and Coden, Alabama, with all of our community hubs. And this is over and above flyers and the web presence. This is an actual face-to-face to talk. And with translation when we work with the Vietnamese American community. And then we're looking at funding to make this thing last, because once the grant is over with, there will be no more funding from that source. And I don't know where we're going with it, but the NSF looked like it might be a good thing. That's all I can say right at the moment. And we're doing a community hub coordinators sampling process evaluation, which is a way of evaluating how well the peer-to-peer communication of risk concept worked in terms of the fishermen and the communities, and are they talking about this issue. These are the parameters for the map platform we're going to put up, and it'll have a drop-down or pop-up GPS, species, date captured, aggregate PAH, aggregate mean actually, and accompanying text defining level of concern. Right now it's benchmarked against benzoapyrene, and that will change as we know more about the actual toxicology of the PAHs we're working with. Benzoapyrene is structurally similar, that's why we're using it. And we're going to have a graphic way of showing that, so that it's not a bunch of numbers in a table, and we will specify the limitations of what the graphic can really say credibly, so that nobody thinks it's, you know, a done deal until it is, if it is. This may go on for a long time. Ready? 2 minutes? Okay. Oh, good. I'm at the last slide. This is a slide I've used before in a couple of other things, but to me, this is the real reason why I enjoy doing this kind of work, because this is how science and communities enrich one another by collaborating on this intimate level. This is a very intimate level of connection. And it's been a real learning experience for the scientists in particular. The community has mostly learned why science takes so long to come up with a conclusion, what the scientific process entails, and why it is so difficult to say something in the middle of even an urgent situation like a large oil problem
in the food web and people wondering, should we eat? Why can't they just say something? Well, I think they understand that part now. And science is understanding why they're so insistent and why they have to change their way of communicating and work with people on the level of where they really are, not expecting them to come up to their level immediately, because that's impossible. I'm not a scientist, and I truly understand this. And that's been my major job, is to talk to science about that. But anyway, the collaborative creation of knowledge provides a wider angle for the research. Very important. It fosters greater procedural and intellectual democracy. To me, that's paramount. Inclusion, transparency, trust, and a Frerian approach to community-based participatory research. It exploits the grassroots strategies that leverage networks that they already have to do things we couldn't do without spending a gazillion dollars. It increases capacity on both ends. And finally, it promotes a greater awareness of the distributive justice implications of what's going on when you do this research. You know, who are the people at risk? What do they need? Not merely how much damage is legal or what level of risk is acceptable. What do these people need to be healthy? And that's a totally different concept. And when you start having this relationship with communities, you have to work on that level, because that's the level they live on. They don't care too much about the nuances of parsing out the metabolites coming off of a PAH as it's processed out of the body. But this stuff is very important to them. And I'm acknowledging the people here that we've worked with, the organizations and people. And once again, I want to especially acknowledge Wilma Subra, our community science consultant, because without her, I don't think we could have done this, because she has the trust of the Gulf. And if she would be with us and say something and reiterate what we said, people would say, okay, we'll buy that. If Wilma says it, it's okay. We don't care what you think. And this is our logo display. And this is the totemic animal of the Seeley Center for Environmental Health and Medicine, the brown pelican. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for John? Yes.
The main thing was we trained about 75 people and probably only got 20 to participate actively. I mean, people would come because they're interested, and then they wouldn't do it. And once again, they would fade off into where they live, which is really rural, so you couldn't even find people. And our coordinators had trouble finding them sometimes, too. There was a dearth of communication connectivity. That was the major problem. They had no problem understanding how to do it, because they work with they work on the water, that's their life. They had problems with the urgency versus scientific timeline problem. That was a big issue. We had to talk and dialogue on that all the time. Where are the results? Where are the results? Why don't you have them yet? And you know, like I said, I think at this point they understand better why it takes so long. Not that they like that idea, because people are eating out of the food web while we're doing this. And they would like to know, is this cool or not? But that's a major problem.
Yes, thanks. Also, congratulations on a pretty much flawless presentation in the presence of that distraction. So one of the things you mentioned was you're looking for more funding to continue this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that community partners are interested in continuing it, and are they interested in just continuing until the question is adequately answered, or do you think they would like those 20 out of 75 volunteers who kept showing up, do you think they would be wanting to set it up as like a longer term?
It was suggested by a couple of those volunteers that we set up a permanent monitoring network, and they would like to be part of it. That's where the idea came from. Now, that said, not everybody would continue, no. A couple of the hubs are very, very enthralled with the idea, some of them less so. It was a lot of work to manage. I don't think they'd want to do it on that level again. But yes, I think there would be response, good positive response from the hubs, and but they would have no way of funding it, no way whatsoever. That was part of the urgency versus scientific timeline issue. Yeah, it was an issue. And all I can say is we had a constant dialogue about it. And the initial part of this was bad because, you know, they wanted it right away. This was when the oil was gushing. Well, no, it wasn't anymore. We didn't get out in the field till that was finished. But the oil was still there. You could still see it in many places. As the oil faded, so did the urgency. And I think that's just human behavior, but I can't say that that was a wonderful part of the project. It was something we had to do, and the learning experience on both sides was definitely valuable, but no, that's something no one will ever come... I don't even come fully to terms with it myself. I mean, it takes too long. And one thing I didn't understand at the front end of the project was that we were working with a set of toxins or possible toxins that hadn't been characterized yet. Because most everybody else that went out looked at what was, you know, pyrogenics. And it's easy. That's done. This isn't done yet. And so that was a learning experience all the way around, a very global thing.